Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the capture of the Mexican drug lord El Chapo Shorty Guzman in a luxury hotel in the tourist resort of Mazatlan. Mexico City-based journalist Joan Grillo, the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, joins us to discuss the role of Mexican Marines in recapturing the fugitive drug lord who Forbes magazine has named number 67 on its list of the world's most powerful people, and what role U.S. intelligence might have played in nabbing Chicago's public enemy number one. Then we will speak with the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer, who is now director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. We will discuss the sudden collapse of the kleptocratic Yanukovych regime and what might follow it to fill the political vacuum, as well as who might pony up to help the almost bankrupt country recover now that Russia's $15 billion loan is likely to be put on hold as the spoiler Putin decides his next move now that his puppet has fled his palace. Then finally, we will speak with the Ukrainian scholar Mykola Rabchuk, a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kiev and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. We will discuss the future of a divided country that has just undergone its third post-Soviet revolution and whether another kleptocrat, Yulia Tymoshenko, who was just released from prison, will fill the void or whether the country could be rebooted in a less corrupt and more lawful direction. And joining us now is Joan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. Based in Mexico City, he has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. His latest book is El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Good to be here.
And obviously the capture of El Chapo Shorty Guzman is a big deal. My understanding is I spoke with Tim Johnson last week about the Three Amigos conference, where the North American summit in Toluca, Mexico, where the three presidents of Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. Met. Tim was telling me that they were hoping to nail somebody, at least Peña Nieto was hoping to nail somebody to go along with the summits, and there was a lot of activity going on in Sinaloa. So little did we know. I guess they captured him a few days later, right?
Well, there was various operations of Marines storming into houses in Culiacán close to the time of the summit. So people made presumptions, are they trying to arrest somebody as the Americans visit. Now, historically, there has often been a case when the Mexican authorities will nab a drug trafficker and parade him in front of the media when the U.S. does come to kind of show, yeah, hey, look, we're fighting the war on drugs. However, with an arrest of this magnitude of Chapo Guzman with a $5 million price on his head, as one former head of international operations for the DEA said to me, he thinks the most important drug trafficker in the world. Another Mexican intelligence official said to me, this is not an arrest you can time. It just happened to really be around the time of the Obama visit. You can't control forces that much. People often have a very conspiratorial idea of Mexican government here, and understandably, there was a one-party rule for 71 years. A lot of the time, the rulers themselves were conspiratorial people. But that was the idea they can pull all the strings. But really, realistically, in a case like this, they can't control the timing. They were pushing it for a long time, and it happened to happen. Right now, the arrest of Chapo Guzman.
So, Joan Grillo, tell me how it happened from your investigation.
Well, the information I have is that there was some raids in Culiacán by the Mexican Marines during the week, and they raided several houses, including one of an ex-wife of Chapo Guzman, a woman called Griselda Lopez. They also raided other there of some security, cartel security people, gunmen who work for the cartel. And in one of these houses, they found some tunnels that Chapo Guzman was using to go into the house and then go out again to other places. They did a tunnel system under Culiacán. Now, Culiacán is the state capital of Sinaloa. Sinaloa is to the Mexican cartels, as Sicily is to the Italian mafia. or the Sicilian mafia. It is the cradle of drug cartels. So on this information, they discovered, they actually found they were very close to him. He'd been in one of his houses very recently. And apparently he made a phone call on a satellite phone, calling for somebody to help him to get him out of Culiacan. And they traced that call and followed him from Culiacan to the nearby seaside resort of Mazatlan, where he went to a luxury seaside apartment with a woman. And they had him cornered there. They went in with the Mexican Marines, and without a shot being fired, arrested him.
So he has been active for an awful long time. I mean, and of course he was captured and held in a maximum security jail and miraculously escaped, obviously with some help from the inside. And there have been other near captures, haven't they?
There have been many times that we've had news coming, you know, like this, like Chapo Guzman's been captured or Chapo Guzman's been killed. So when the news first broke, the journalists who covered this a lot, you know, took a breath for a moment, see if it was really the case or yet another false alarm. You know, you have many times about 2 years ago in Baja California Sur, in Los Cabos Resort, they said they almost had him. You know, he was going to be there and they missed him. Then we suddenly had a report about a year ago of he was killed in Guatemala in a shootout. So there's kind of a lot of rumors around. But in this case, you know, it seems to be the one that they did have him. Yeah, it has been a long time. It's been 13 years since he escaped from a Mexican prison. He was originally arrested back in 94 and then held for until 2001 when he escaped under then-President Vicente Fox. He survived the whole of the Fox presidency, the Felipe Calderón presidency, despite a military offensive against drug cartels. And under Peña Nieto, he has been captured.
So what about his sons, Ivan Archivaldo Guzman Salazar and Ovidio Guzman Lopez, and also Guzman's father-in-law, Inez Coronel? He was arrested nearly a year ago. Have they been leaning on the family?
They certainly would have been leaning on anybody they had arrested to give up information, but Chapo Guzman was a very clever, sophisticated trafficker, and he had ways, the reason he survived for so long was he had kind of ways of need to know stuff, so I think those people who'd been arrested would be kept from having information that would be liable to give him away. But all the time, the way that the drug enforcement works is by arresting people and getting them to snitch on other people, leaning on them and putting pressure or paying them large amounts of money. And the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration pays rewards up to $5 million. It had a $5 million reward on Chapo Guzman, which means somebody could be claiming that for giving information leading to that arrest and obviously making themselves a millionaire by giving that there. They have ways. Also, they have also technology as well in terms of phone taps. Now, he was very clever about, you know, wouldn't use a regular cell phone. They'd have quite sophisticated communications. But then again, there's now been quite a sophisticated way of tracing those communications. So kind of a spy back and forth war.
Again, I'm speaking with Juan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. Based in Mexico City, he has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. His latest book is El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. So I have been talking to people recently, including Jeremy Scahill, who wrote the book Dirty Wars and the movie of that same title, Dirty Wars. It's up for the Academy Award this year as Best Documentary Feature. And he just mentioned that he's with this new media venture that's financed by the eBay billionaire, along with Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. And he was saying that there's a lot of Joint Special Operations Command, the people who got bin Laden, that they've been active in Mexico and that was a story that he was following. Do you have any evidence that U.S. intelligence assets or boots on the ground in Mexico were involved with this capture of Guzman?
I'd be interested to hear what he has from his investigation. The U.S., I followed for a long time the DEA operations in Mexico. And also there's been the CIA have been here as well, and there was a case about a year and a half ago, members of the CIA being attacked and shot at in Mexico by, probably by, in fact, the rival of Chapo Guzman. But Normally, the DA operations are more about them paying informants, let's say, paying big amounts of money. And also, they have ways of kind of setting up infiltrating drug cartels. I've interviewed DA agents who have infiltrated the cartels by pretending to be drug traffickers themselves. And it's kind of more gaining human intelligence. In terms of more of the kind of spy technology referred to that, things like drones, things like tracing equipment, this is very possible. There's been one thing there has been in this administration is a bit less real-time communication. That was considered a big deal when Peña Nieto first came in. He started to slow down the kind of communication between U.S. agencies and Mexican agencies. And so this should kind of go through formal channels rather than everybody talking to each other on the ground and kind of going back and forth. But, you know, it's hard to know. You know, it's very possible there was some more shared information there. There was definitely, you'll see, some level of U.S. involvement. I talked to one official who's quite close both to the Mexican Marines and the U.S. intelligence community, who he believed that this is largely, the credit was largely the Mexicans in this particular bus, that they, it was their intelligence on the ground and there was some U.S. involvement. But, you know, we'll have to wait for all the evidence to come out, and like, I'll be interested to hear what evidence he's found himself.
Well, just to touch on the history of Guzman, of how long he's been operating, I recall that in the early 1980s, when the Ariana Felix organization out of Tijuana went to Guadalajara to try and kill Chapo Guzman, they sent their hit team down there. They actually hired a street gang from San Diego to do the hit, and they couldn't find him. So they go back to the airport to catch the plane back to Tijuana, and then they run into Chapo Guzman's people in the airport at Guadalajara, and a huge shootout ensues, and they assassinate the papal nuncio from the Vatican, mistaking him for El Chapo Guzman, who dressed in you know, disguised as a cardinal or whatever. And that got a lot of international attention. So this has been going on for an awful long time.
Yeah, it certainly has. Chapo Guzman is from this community in Padre Huato, Sinaloa. It's a mountainous community on the Sierra Madre Occidental where people have actually been growing drugs and trafficking drugs for 100 years. Right back when the United States first made opium or restricted opium under the Harrison's Narcotics Tax Act of 1914, there was a trade from Sinaloa State to the U.S. And so the community where Chapo Guzman was born, a small village called La Tuna in this Padre Huato municipality, was already a drug trafficking community back then in the 1950s. They used to call the opium people who beat opium gummers because of the opium gum. And even the local baseball team was known as the Gummers because of the association with opium and this part of Sinaloa State. So he was born there in this place, born into a trafficking community, grew up under various traffickers in the 1980s, as you say, and then was caught in this beef with the Ariana Felix cartel. Now, following that, there was pressure on the Mexican government then to arrest traffickers. So they got Chapo Guzman in 94 in Guatemala. He was put into a prison and then escaped from there in 2001. Now, since 2001, he really came forward as this major kingpin, the biggest drug trafficker, the person who tried to claim the entire 2,000-mile Mexican border. He wanted to traffic his drugs through Tijuana, through Juarez, and through the northeast, through Nuevo Laredo, and fought a whole series of turf wars with other cartels. And that was part of this catastrophic cycle of violence. The 70,000 people who have been killed in the cartel-related violence since 2006.
So he has clearly built this massive empire going, you know, back from when he started in the 80s and accidentally shot the papal nuncio. Or he didn't do it, but the AFO people did, trying to get him, the street gang from San Diego, who, by the way, were able to board the plane, Aeromexico plane, in first class with their machine guns still smoking and fly back to Tijuana and cross the border back into the United States. I mean, the whole thing was pretty brazen, but it did create an international incident. But I guess since then, though, he's made a fortune. Forbes magazine have indicated he's one of the richest, if not the richest, drug trafficker in the world. And he seems to have a lot of connections to Chicago, which is where the U.S. would like to put him on trial.
Yeah, well, there's a whole bunch of places who would love to put Chappell Guzman on trial. He's got indictments for him in Chicago, but also indictments for him in San Diego and in New York. But in Chicago, where they really made a big case, where the big City Crime Commission named him public enemy number one, the first person to be named that since Al Capone. There was a case there in Chicago against the Sinaloa cartel, where they say, you know, they said it was making absolutely billions, moving the drugs from the Mexican border in trailer trucks up there, using Chicago as a big hub to supply the whole eastern seaboard up into Canada, a whole bunch of cities from there. An ongoing case that they've been extradited to Chicago, the son of another associate of Chappell Guzman called Ismael Miles Zambada. His son has already been extradited up to Chicago, and they have a couple of American-born twins who also they were working with the Sinaloa cartels from there. They were son of another drug trafficker from the Sinaloa Durango area, and they're involved in that case. Well, it's a very, very big ongoing case. They'd love to have him there. But so in other places, but then Chappell Guzman's lawyers will try to fight to keep him in Mexico. It seems convenient, perhaps, for the Mexican authorities for him to be extradited, so they don't have the responsibility anymore of keeping him in prison. You know, obviously, we've seen the history that he's escaped from a prison before, and there's been a whole bunch of prison escapes, some quite incredible prison escapes in recent years, some involving more than 100 prisoners, sometimes supported by helicopters. So it could be convenient for him to be flown up to the U.S., where he wouldn't, you know, see daylight for a long time.
So it's not out of the question, then, that he could get extradited to face trial in Chicago, then. It's a terrible admission for the Mexican authorities that their prisons are so porous.
Yep. That's correct. It's a big problem here with law enforcement. The prison systems themselves have been overwhelmed in recent years. When you've arrested tens and thousands of drug traffickers, of hired killers, and there really hasn't been much space for them. So there's been a very violent environment in the prisons as well. A lot of people murdered and riots. They have these special high security prisons where Chappell Guzman is now. He's in the number one high security prison. The army is around it. So really a prison escape is extremely difficult, hard to imagine. But still, if he was in Mexico, the pressure would be there for years and years, always the pressure of knowing he's there, of knowing he'd like to escape, of knowing he has billions of dollars at his resources and many people who answer to his calls, who carry out killings at his call. So it could be a solution for Mexican government simply to extradite him.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Joan Grillo.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Joan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. Based in Mexico City, has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. His latest book is El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. ¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Piper, who is the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine and Russia issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Piper.
Thank you for having me today.
And clearly, it's been extraordinary change in Ukraine. The idea you've had months and months of increasingly bloody confrontation resulting in recent sniper fire against the opposition, and then suddenly the Yanukovych disappears, the riot police disappear, melt into the night, Yanukovych disappears, and now you've got the opposition strolling through this vast, opulent, kind of tacky Disneyland that the kleptocrat embezzled. What do you make of it all?
No, it's been just a whirlwind in the last 4 days. On Thursday, Ukraine literally was on the brink of violent chaos with fighting going on. On Friday, Mr. Yanukovych and the opposition leaders negotiate a settlement. It moves very quickly. The first step called for in that settlement is a return to the 2004 Ukrainian constitution, and the Ukrainian parliament overwhelmingly approves that. Friday night, Mr. Yanukovych disappears. Yesterday, in Kyiv, the police are gone. The authorities are disappearing. You basically have the parliament with significant defections to the opposition from Mr. Yanukovych's party, the Party of Regions, approving a new speaker. That speaker today was appointed the acting president. They plan to appoint a new unity government, and people are still trying to figure out where Mr. Yanukovych is.
Well, apparently he's addressed television, speaking in Russian, presumably from the area close to the Russian border. What do you make, though, of the idea that Yulia Tymoshenko, who has been released from prison, is certainly getting media attention? And I'm wondering whether that's out of the frying pan into the fire in terms of, I mean, she's a minor kleptocrat compared to Yanukovych, but her aide was busted for money laundering, presumably laundering her money. It would be a tragedy, would it not? This is the third post-Soviet revolution, is it not? And one would hope it could finally turn in a positive direction.
Well, this is going to be, I think, one of the big questions for the next coming days and weeks. Ms. Tymoshenko should have been freed as she was from jail yesterday. The charges that put her into jail in 2011 were totally politically motivated, and the trial, by all accounts, was a total sham. But there is a big question. While she's been in jail, you've had three other political leaders, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who's basically managed her party while she's been in jail, Vitaly Klitschko, the former heavyweight boxer who heads his own party, and then Oleg Gatchanibuk, who heads a right-wing party mainly based in western Ukraine. Those three have worked together actually fairly well during this crisis. And so the question is, how does that dynamic change with Ms. Tymoshenko back? And you also, though, it's interesting, looking at sort of just reactions that people are picking up on the streets, is there is a sense that you get from the demonstrators that, A, they may look to new political leaders. They may see this group as sort of part of the old, or at a minimum, they're going to have very high expectations for their performance. And there's even talk, for example, of continuing the demonstrations in central Kyiv until they have a degree of confidence that the new leadership is moving Ukraine in the direction that they would like.
So, Stephen Piper, what do you think, though, is going on with Putin now? I mean, he, in effect, brought this on himself by forcing Ukraine into an either-or situation. It's either the EU or us, and he sort of bribed them with this $15 billion loan, which presumably is not going to be forthcoming, or at least the balance of it won't be. He sees things in zero-sum terms, does he not? So he's likely to be the spoiler, isn't he?
Well, he has that potential. I think it's likely that that Mr. Putin will see this as a setback for his interests. he's been fairly clearly working over the last years to build a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space. And if now a Ukraine with a new government begins to resume its course towards the European Union, that leaves a big hole in that sphere. So I think he is looking at ways to try to see if he can exert influence, and Russia does have levers. They showed last summer that they could cut off Ukrainian imports. As you said, it's unclear whether they will continue the $15 billion credit line. Will they reverse the gas price cut that they granted Ukraine back in December? So there's a lot of economic levers he has. And the unfortunate thing here is when you kind of step back, though, and ask, you know, if Ukraine draws closer to the European Union and has a trade relationship with Europe, the European Union is not NATO. And if that Ukraine still has a positive, constructive relationship with Russia, that shouldn't be seen as a threat to Moscow. But my guess is that Mr. Putin is playing a different game, and he will work those levers. The question is whether those levers will have much impact. You know, my guess is that this struggle for Ukraine is going to be settled first and foremost by the Ukrainians.
So is there a way, though, cure? I mean, my understanding is that not only is the country bankrupt, it's also spectacularly corrupt at every level. To get anything done, you've got to bribe people, and apparently that weighs on the Ukrainian people. And I've spoken to Ukrainians who've talked about trying to get, you know, young entrepreneurs trying to start a business, and they're refusing to pay bribes. They're trying to live like the Europeans in a kind of rule of law environment. Is it possible that they can be given an infusion of support, and that the country could head in that direction?
Yeah, I'm hopeful on this. I mean, this crisis began 3 months ago when the Ukrainian government suspended the negotiation of the conclusion of an association agreement with the European Union. But it's changed since then, and I think what you have on the street are lots of people who are just tired of the authoritarianism, and they're tired of the corruption. I mean, when they look towards Europe, it's not just the attraction of EU living standards, but it's also that dull, boring, democratic rule of law, and I think people want that. I think there's also a recognition that they had a huge opportunity after the Orange Revolution back in 2004, and they missed that opportunity. So my guess is you're going to have a lot of people in Ukraine now saying, this is our second chance. We're looking towards the government that's now being formed to deliver on things, and very high on that list is going to be, we want an end to corruption. We're tired of this. It's going to be a difficult struggle because rooting out corruption is never easy, but my guess is that's going to be something that people are going to be watching very, very closely. And it will be, I think, spurred somewhat by these incredible pictures coming out of Mr. Yanukovych's estate just outside of Kyiv. And which really give, I think, a new definition to the term conspicuous consumption.
So, but what, when you talk about the failure of the Orange Revolution, a lot of that can be leveled at Yulia Tymoshenko, who was the prime minister, and she did nothing but fight with the president. It was totally dysfunctional, and she's not exactly without sin herself in terms of corruption. So it would seem to me that that would be, unfortunate if she made a political comeback.
Well, and this will be a question. I mean, my guess is that she wants to play a political role, but it's been interesting in just sort of watching Ukrainian blogs and the Twitter world is I think there are a number of people who are looking at her and saying, maybe her time has passed. Maybe it's time for new leadership here. But again, I think a lesson that any politician who wants to succeed in the coming months in Ukraine is going to have to take is that it's very important to be on the right side of the anti-corruption battle, because that's something that has been a big motivation for people that have been out in the streets through a very long, cold winter in Kyiv.
And as you were just saying, there are more and more evidence of the excesses of the kleptocratic Yanukovych family is going to come to light. So that will be exacerbating the, and reminding people of corruption. How though, is Putin going to handle the fact that his idea of an alternative to the EU which involves Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, looks pretty much dead in the water. Ukraine is a huge, important country with tremendous resources. It's the breadbasket, etc. Russia trades a lot with Ukraine, and presumably they wouldn't be happy about losing that market.
Yeah, well, again, my hope would be that Putin would step back and say, look, Ukraine that's deepening its relationship with the European Union but still has a positive, constructive relationship with Russia, you know, that's not a threat. But my guess is that he's playing a different game here. And he will be tempted, I think, to use some of the economic levers he has to pressure Ukraine. The most worrisome thing would be were he to try to encourage separatist tendencies in the eastern part of the country. Although so far, it's interesting that even some of the regional leaders are now saying, look, you know, we may not be totally happy with what took place in Kyiv, but you know, we still see a Ukrainian state. We're not talking about leaving. But it would be prudent both for the new government in Ukraine and I think for the United States and the European Union, which would like to see this new government succeed in divining a course that takes Ukraine down a democratic path that builds a stronger, more stable economy. But it would be prudent to think about how they would deal if Mr. Putin exercised some of the levers that he has at hand.
Well, apparently he had a conversation by phone with President Obama, and the relationship between the two was not particularly good. What is your understanding of do you know anything about that conversation and whether they have any kind of working relationship at this point?
Well, the readout of the conversation seemed to be fairly positive and such. But the more important thing is going to be to watch and see the actions that Mr. Putin takes. Now, to some extent, for the last 2 weeks, he's been thoroughly distracted by the Sochi Games. Those are now over, and the question is, as he turns back to other business, my guess would be what to do about Ukraine is going to be at the top of his inbox. And we may get some indications in the next few days how Russia intends to respond. It was not positive that the Russian foreign minister yesterday was talking about extremists in Kyiv and some kind of a coup. That suggested a certain narrative has taken hold in Moscow with regards to what happened. But we'll just have to see what Russia plans to do about this.
But the Russian media propaganda, which is entirely controlled now that Echo's gone and the last non-governmental TV cable channel's gone, you know, they've really been beating the drum about these terrorists and fascists taking over.
Oh, yeah.
How are they going to walk back from that?
No, I mean, and this is one of the things that, to some extent, Mr. Putin may have created something of an expectation. And I think when Putin looks at what's going on in Ukraine, it's not just the question of his view or his vision of Russia as a superpower having a sphere of influence. Ukraine is very important from that point of view. But there's probably a strong domestic political element here, is that pulling Ukraine closer to Russia undoubtedly appeals to conservative elements in Mr. Putin's domestic political constituency. And he probably is looking for ways to avoid being seen as somebody who lost Ukraine. Now, I would argue that Ukraine was lost back in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed and the Ukrainian country became an independent state. But there, unfortunately, are a number of Russians who are not yet reconciled to that.
So what do you think is going to happen to the billionaires, in particular Yanukovych's staunchest ally, the billionaire businessman, and the richest man in Ukraine, Rinat Akhmetov?
My understanding is he's actually in London now. I think a number of people who are very close to Mr. Yanukovych have left the country and are waiting to see how the dust settles. Now, Akhmetov also was trying to position himself with a foot in both camps. I mean, he had been calling for a peaceful resolution of the crisis. He came out late, but he still came out with a criticism of the use of force. But I think he's trying to see what's going to happen and what the new government means for oligarchs who had been close to the previous regime.
So, but don't the public, and particularly the opposition, who pretty much have triumphed, at least in the western part of the country, don't they despise these guys?
They do, but I think one of the questions that they're going to have to sort out, and this will be one of the tough questions, is when you look back, how far do you go back in terms of righting wrongs that were done? My guess would be it's going to be important to find a balance. I mean, I think there are some cases that were so egregious, there has to be some call to accountability. But it's also important that the new government not get so bogged down in investigating and righting every wrong of the past 20 years that it loses sight of what its main function is, which is to return Ukraine to a sense of normalcy, to build the economy, reform the economy, and deal with some pretty pressing financial challenges that are coming, and then also to really institutionalize a more democratic form of government. So they're going to have to find that balance between looking at the past, but also addressing the problems that are going to be much more important for the country's future.
Well, I recently spoke with a Swedish diplomat who spends a lot of time in Ukraine and knows it well, and he was saying that the Yanukovych family, particularly Alexander, the former dentist, the eldest son, they have basically embezzled something as much as 6% of the country's GDP. They'll clearly, with all these pictures that you're talking about of the opulence that now the general public are going to be seeing, the way that they lived inside the palace walls, isn't there going to be a call for that national patrimony to be returned?
Oh, yes. In fact, one of the votes that was taken in the Ukrainian parliament today has nationalized or renationalized the estate that Mr. Yanukovych had allegedly as private property just outside of Kyiv. And there will be that. And this is an area where Western countries can help. Because a lot of these people, including people fairly close to Mr. Yanukovych, I believe, parked their money outside of Ukraine because they were not fully confident in Ukrainian financial institutions. So a lot of that money is sitting in Western banks. And the question is, can the West help Ukraine identify that money and freeze it in those cases where money clearly can be traced back to, you know, this was stolen from the Ukrainian budget, return it to the Ukrainian budget and such. And that will require some good cooperation between the Ukrainians as they develop evidence. And apparently, along with everything else in the estate, they found a lot of paper, and they're going through a lot of documents to try to track things, including one receipt for $12 million in cash that was being shown around on the Twitter world yesterday. If they can track that and then work with Western investigating agencies, maybe they can freeze some of this money and arrange for its return back to the Ukrainian budget.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Pieper, what's your feeling? Optimism that Putin won't, even if he is trying to be the spoiler, that have things moved too far in the direction against him?
I'm a lot more optimistic the last 3 days than I was earlier last week, where Ukraine literally was on the brink. I think Ukrainians now have charge of their fate. Russia certainly, as I said, will be tempted to try some levers, but I think Ukraine is capable of resisting that. But it would be prudent for Ukraine and Ukraine's friends in the West to sort of figure out how they would deal with some of those questions. You know, if Russia, for example, resorts to economic sanctions, are there things that they can do in terms of opening Western markets that might help compensate? But Ukraine has today probably the best chance it has to move to becoming a normal European country since the Orange Revolution, and I desperately hope that they do not miss that opportunity again.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Stephen Pieper.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pieper, who's the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kyiv, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a Ukrainian scholar about rebooting Ukraine.
Yeah, it seems like. Yeah, it feels like. Yeah, it seems like. Yeah, it feels like. Yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mykola Rabchuk, who is a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kiev and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. He is a visiting fellow at the Institute of Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mykola Rabchuk.
Yeah, hello.
So it looks as if the Yanukovych regime ended not with a bang, but with a whimper. I mean, it's as though his Praetorian Guard, the riot police, just melted, and suddenly the palace gates were open and the protesters were able to wander inside this vast kind of Disneyland of techie opulence. Is that what happened?
Yes, and this is the typical way of many authoritarian regimes crumbling. You know, they look strong, but as soon as they begin to crash, they may disappear within a few hours. Yeah, it's another paradox.
Well, at this point, the political handicappers, you know, the ones that make bets on who's up and who's down, are talking about Yulia Tymoshenko as the new front runner, and that her party is pretty much filling the vacuum. She's not exactly without sin herself, is she? I mean, there have been reports in the past of corruption, and a close aide was caught money laundering, and it's quite possible he was laundering her money. So surely we're not going to go from one kleptocrat to another, are we?
Yes, it's quite possible. And by the way, this is exactly I would rather discourage Madame Tymoshenko from running, even though she probably wouldn't listen to me. I feel that, you know, it's time for Ukraine to reset the entire system, to reload it, and for this goal we need absolutely new people, or at least people who have no corruption tails behind them. And I feel that either Klitschko or Yatsenyuk could be this type of people, but certainly not Tymoshenko. I'm afraid that she may play rather a role of spoiler in this forthcoming election. So personally, I'm happy that she was released, of course, because she was absolutely imprisoned and illegitimately. But I would like actually to take some treatment in Germany and maybe to come back to business or to do with charity or whatever. But I feel that both she and Yushchenko, they lost their chance to become national leaders, and I don't think that they should repeat this mistake again.
So are there people that have emerged from the opposition who clearly ultimately were victorious, and they were extremely brave? At the end there, they were facing sniper fire from the government snipers. What about the boxer, Klitschko?
Well, I have rather good impression from Boxer, actually. Well, he's not a professional politician, but he's a man who has very good image. He's pretty popular in Ukraine, and nobody suspects that he's corrupt, that he's running for presidency just to, you know, to benefit financially or something. So, of course, he may be criticized as not very experienced politician, but it's a matter of team of advisors, and I believe that today in Ukraine we have a pretty good generation of young people who are competent, who are specialists in various fields. It's a matter of political will to change the country, and I feel that Klitschko has this political will, and the most important thing, of course, that he's not corrupt, and I feel that he's ready to establish this new system. Ukraine requires fundamental reloading.
It requires fundamental what?
Reloading, reset.
Reboot, as they say.
Yeah, reboot, that's a very good term. Yeah. Yes, because, you know, all the institutions in Ukraine have been completely destroyed by Yanukovych and his people. They were weak all the time in Ukraine, but Yanukovych basically killed everything, killed court system, police, whatever, you know. So everything should be built from scratch.
But what about building a kind of a sense of morality, if you will? My understanding is that it's one of the most corrupt countries in the world in terms of doing business. It wasn't just that you had this crooked family running the country and looting it, with the dentist's son shaking down all of the oligarchs and saying, I'm your new partner. Apparently, throughout the entire country, people have to pay bribes for just about to get anything done. Is there a way to reboot and re-engineer that whole thing? I mean, doesn't that get into the area of personal and social morality?
Well, I recognize that this is a very difficult task, but at the same time, I feel there are good chances for that, because all the people, or at least the majority, absolute majority of the people, are tired with this system, and most of them would like to change it. Not only common people who are absolutely exhausted by this immoral system, but also a substantial part of the elite, including the oligarchs. They would feel much more comfortable under the rule of law. Of course, maybe their incomes initially would decline, but ultimately even their wealth would increase, because, you know, the same real estate, the same factories or whatever in the stable country are much more expensive than in the unstable country. So it's also in their interest. I feel there is some, you know, social consensus for reboot. Everything we needed, I feel, the political will and good example. Because, you know, no reboot can occur if we don't introduce zero tolerance. And this zero tolerance should be introduced, of course, from the top. You cannot demand, you know, decent behavior from some, you know, rot police officer if you have huge corruption on the top. So this is why I pay so high attention, you know, to the moral stance of the top leaders. It's very important, you know. People would accept it if they see that it's serious, that it's not just words but deeds.
Well, that would mean that Yulia Tymoshenko simply, if she were to fill the power vacuum, that would be a disaster, would it not, in terms of what you just said?
I'm afraid of this development. Actually, you know, I wouldn't like her to win. I would prefer her to not to run at all, and I hope she would be discouraged to do this. But also, so far, I don't see that she's a leader, actually, you know, because all the previous ratings, I haven't seen new opinion surveys, but until recently, she dragged far behind either Klitschko or even some other leaders.
Right.
So,
well, let me again remind the audience that I'm speaking with Mykola Rabchik, who is a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kiev and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. He is a visiting fellow at the Institute of Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. So, given that the country is bankrupt, in the $15 billion from Russia is not likely to be forthcoming, and in many ways it seems as if Putin brought this confrontation on himself by forcing the Ukrainians to choose between the EU and Russia, and it would seem that is a false choice. I mean, isn't it possible for Ukraine to have relations with both EU and Russia without it being mutually exclusive?
It's a very nice idea, and of course I would like it to be implemented. But you know, it's hardly possible with today's Russia, with Putin's Russia. Let's be realistic. You know very well that Russia plays zero sum game. It's, you know, everybody knows Russia is playing zero sum game, and you cannot play with a partner, with whoever who is playing this game. You should play the same game. It's impossible. It's just, you know, theory of games. You cannot win if you don't recognize this reality. So maybe sometime in the future, when Russia would democratize, when Russia would become normal country, maybe we would be able to build normal relations. But now, you know, they would like either, you know, everything or nothing. Of course, they would like everything, not nothing. But there is no other option. That's the problem.
So what do you think Putin's next move will be then?
Well, nobody knows, actually. I hope, you know, from my point of view, as long as I observe Russian behavior, this regime is pretty opportunistic. So they have some feeling of red line, which can be overstepped or not. They are not, you know, crazy adventurers who are ready to do whatsoever. They feel what is possible and not. Probably maximum they can do now in the current situation is just to play the usual role of spoiler. They can orchestrate some provocations to encourage some, you know, elements in Ukraine. They may, especially, you know, they may stage some provocations in Crimea because they have really, this is probably the only region where they have serious influence. But still, you know, it largely depends also on Ukraine society, Ukraine authorities, on international reactions. So I wouldn't exaggerate Russian, you know, strength and so on. Yeah, they can play the role of spoiler, but not to lead, you know, any processes.
Well, though, after World War II, there was a guerrilla movement in the west of Ukraine fighting the Red Army for a number of years, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, and there were tremendous casualties on both sides. Presumably, Russia has memories of that. Is there that possibility that if Russia tries to militarize the situation, that there'd be you could have a kind of guerrilla war?
Well, I don't think that Russia would try to do it. Actually, there is no need so far for guerrilla war because Ukraine has its own army, and I believe that at least some part of this army would be able to fight. So, Kremlin is pretty aware of this. So, you know, it's not country like Georgia. It's much bigger and much stronger, and international reaction probably would be also much stronger than in the case of Georgia, which is remote and virtually unknown country. Actually, it was a very bad lesson, I feel. At that time, international community did not behave the best way, especially European Union. But still, I hope they draw some lessons from 2008. So, you know, actually, I don't believe in this apocalyptic scenario, even though, of course, nothing can be excluded in case of Kremlin. But it's very unlikely, very, very unlikely.
But the Kremlin does, Putin's idea and why he forced Yanukovych to ditch the EU deal and join his economic union is that Russia, that's a huge market for Russian goods, the Ukraine, and it makes Putin's Eurasian market look pretty pathetic, doesn't it, if he's only got Belarus and Kazakhstan.
Well, first of all, we have to think about a global market, because as long as Ukrainians would produce something for this peculiar Eurasian, Russian, Kazakhstan, Belarusian market, you know, they would never modernize their economy. There are no incentives to modernize economy. So I feel this is, you know, way to nowhere. Of course, Ukrainians would face some difficult period at the beginning until they rebuild, reconstruct the economy. But, you know, I hope that they would get some support from the EU. They have to show, first of all, the political will that they would like to change the country. Ukrainians finally accomplished something they had to do back in 1991. In general, I consider this process in Ukraine, this revolution, as a third attempt to finish the unfinished business of 1989, of this, you know, anti-communist revolutions in Eastern Europe. Ukrainians failed in 1991, Ukrainians failed during the Orange Revolution, and now they have the third chance and to normalize the country, yes. So they should do this, and of course, it would take a lot of time and efforts, but Ukraine is a pretty rich country. It's not, you know, it's not like Greece or Bosnia or whatever. It's really a country which could produce whatsoever, and it simply requires some good management, because for years it was mismanaged. And in this regard, of course, European Union can do a lot, can provide some guardianship, some assistance, some technical support. Actually, you know, Ukrainians do not need the fish which is offered by Russia. Ukrainians need fish roads. And European Union probably is in position to provide these fish roads.
I see. In other words, give a man a fish, he eats for one day. If you teach a man to fish and give him a fishing rod, he can eat forever, right? That's the
yes,
old expression.
Yes, this is what Euromaidan was about. You know, people at Euromaidan, they did not expect that, you know, European Union would immediately bring you money or whatever. They wanted from the government to behave like in European Union, to introduce system of justice, rules like in the European Union. This was main demand, justice, rule of law, freedom, civil rights, and on and on.
I see. So in terms of Putin's paranoia about NATO and European and American expansion into the East, and of course the Russian security people obviously recorded that conversation with the U.S. State Department official and the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, which they, leaked. So tell me, what do you think can be done to assuage Putin's paranoia, or is it just there's nothing can be done? He's the way he is, and until you have, Russia is effectively run by a criminal, and a criminal class. Your feeling is that until they go away, I mean, when are the criminals going to go away? That's not what they normally do, is it?
Well, frankly speaking, I don't believe that anything can be done with this regime. I observed Russian propaganda during all these events, during Euromaidan. It's absolutely crazy. It's Goebbels-style propaganda. They invent such fantastic stories. They distort reality so much. And I'm really afraid that they begin to believe in their own propaganda. This is the most dangerous thing, of course. I feel that the best way to help Russia today is just to help Ukraine. It's my feeling is. Because if Ukrainians manage to transform their country, and they have a very good chance now, it would be excellent example for Russians. You know, they probably would be encouraged by this way. And this is what Putin is afraid of, actually. And, of course, this regime is so far it looks like well entrenched and very strong. But, you know, Yanukovych also looked very strong, and Ceausescu looks very strong. But suddenly, you know, such regimes may crumble very, very rapidly at any moment. Very often they appear to be like, paper tigers. So, yeah, it's a matter of time.
Well, Mykola Rabchuk, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mykola Rabchuk, who's a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kiev and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. He is a visiting fellow at the Institute of Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rochert. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.